Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, and this is the Limark Technical Met. Limark Technical Met has been going on since 1982, Sunday night at 8 p.m. And so this is yet another Sunday night, yet another 8 p.m. I'll consider this our Tropical Storm Henri edition of the Technical Met. And let me give you the usual information. If you want to contact me and you can't get through by the radio, email will suffice. The purpose for that is if you have any questions you'd like to ask, we call those mailbag questions when the person isn't here on the net, or if you would like to suggest a topic for discussion, or if you would like to share a puzzle of a technical nature that we could use to interest the audience and perhaps reteach them some basic concepts of technology. I like puzzles, but they're kind of few and far between, unfortunately. And or if you want me to tap Paul, WS2N of SpaceNet Report fame, on the shoulder and ask him to take a look-see at something you've seen, a NASA release or a Space Report release, and make a comment upon it. So the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@, my call sign is AlphaCharlie2GulfSierra.com. I have a bunch of links available. So at your leisure, they're up 24/7. Any old time that you want to, you can take a gander. Some of them are interesting stories that I have seen. Sometimes they're interesting YouTube that you might want to watch. So that's available on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com. We have a chat room available. You can either go to Limark's own website and find the link, or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. Also, I stream this. If you have any friends who don't have a radio or they're not nearby and can't pick up our signal, we stream it across the internet. Just point your browser to technet.ac2gs.com, and that will give you the audio stream. I try to do that 24/7. And of course, I want to remind everyone of Mike AC2NJI's wonderful archive of the Technical Net. His archives go as far back as September of 2006. They're available at his website. He's had over 1 million visitors so far, and hopefully he'll make 2 million one of these days. And that site is called amateurradio.tv. Again, amateurradio.tv. So let me drop for a second. Okay. As always, I like to tell people what I have planned for you, assuming that my radio, my amplifier, my antenna, and sundry bits and pieces of our repeater allow me to do that. The plan is to call for any technical questions. I'll ask for people to give me their call sign if they have any technical questions, the topics they'd like to discuss, or comments they'd like to make if they were here previously and some things were discussed and they went out and tested and tried it and figured something out and would like to share with us. When we run out of those, we'll open it for any kind of technical question, anything science-related or even generally medically related. There will be no net-based diagnoses or consultations, but if you want to discuss the subject, I'm certainly available for it. That should take us to about 10:15, in which I will call upon Paul to bring us the SpaceNet report, which will take us to 11 p.m. I'll return and wish you all well, tie a bow on it, and call it a week. So that's my plan. I hope we are able to stick to it. I hope we have a lot of participation tonight. I realize that everyone was a little bit anxious about Henri. Thankfully, Henri is not as much of a problem as it was supposed to be. So once again, if anyone has any questions of a technical nature, please give me your first name and your call sign.
10 WB2 KWC.
Can recognize. Anyone else want to put their name down for tonight?
Comment about HD radio.
Okay, I think, Paul, you doubled with UDU, so I have UDU and I have WS2N.
Very good, that's true, WS2N.
Sorry, KD2 UDU supporting the
name. Okay, once again, this is AC2GS. If anyone else wants to put their name on the list for any technical questions or statements, comments about something that they tried and whether it worked or didn't work and they want to share it with us, please give us your first name and your call sign. Okay, we'll start off, we have two people. Hopefully, as time goes on, there'll be more people with questions or comments or what have you. Ken, WB2KWC, what's your question or topic for tonight?
Okay, thank you, Roy. It's an electronics question. I'm used to incandescent bulbs. You apply electricity, a filament heats up and glows. You remove the electricity and the filament stops glowing and cools down. You turn the bulb on and off enough times, you're kind of flexing the filament, it expands and contracts, and eventually it breaks and you need to replace the bulb. Now we come across LED lights that go on and off lots of times. I'm especially thinking of the LEDs that are in network routers that go on and off thousands and thousands of times. So I'm wondering, does the on-off cycle affect the life of the LEDs? Or is there something else that does, or do they just keep on going like the Energizer Rabbit? AC2GS, WB2KWC.
Okay, Ken, that's a good question. It is my understanding that as you mentioned, incandescent lights have some mechanical aspect to them. When they go on, they make a significant thermal change because they're operating under primarily high heat will produce black body radiation. And matter of fact, incandescent light bulbs in the early industrial phase of building them was a very strong financial impetus in physicists being able to understand the concept of black body radiation. Manufacturers like to know what kind of quality light is given off based upon the temperature of the thermal element in the incandescent light. But as you mentioned, cycles of heat and cold and heat and cold and heat and cold on most of these incandescent materials prematurely age them. Solid-state physics, thankfully, is a little different than that. There's no real mechanical stresses that I'm aware of just on on-off cycles. Very often you'll see that LEDs are strobe more usually than not. One of the ways that they produce variable intensities can be through adjusting the amount of time that it's on during the pulse mode. So pulsing LEDs doesn't seem to inflict any damage. What inflicts damage to LEDs is thermal problems. Not generally the LED themselves, they tend to be rather efficient, but the power supply that powers them is a different thing entirely. So you tend to want to keep it as cool as possible. So that's the problem. So you'll have things with, let me drop for a second just to make sure that I haven't timed out. Okay, just wanted to double check that. Anyway, as I was saying, the problem with LEDs, especially at the beginning, was that the electronics dissipated way too much heat, was way too inefficient, and would heat up the LEDs, and also LEDs tend to produce their own heat just from, you know, loss as well. So thermal engineering was very important. There were some LED bulbs that if you inserted them in the wrong orientation, they were designed to dissipate heat in one orientation and not dissipate heat as well in another. So it's just the thermal aspect, the heat generally of either the production of the light going to the LEDs or the power supply feeding the LEDs that prematurely will age an LED. The duty cycle is thankfully unaffected as far as I'm aware.
Okay, thank you, Ray. I was just, you know, curious. You know, I'm used to incandescent bulbs, and then I see this little LED jack gadget going on, you know, all these thousands of times, and I was curious.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an interesting subject. Like I said, incandescent light is almost classical physics. Black body radiation is kind of the very beginning of quantum physics. The guy who discovered the equation, Planck, is the grandfather or the father of quantum mechanics. But you know, at that point, no one quite knew what Planck's equation really meant. He had come up with it on a train ride, supposedly, just as a means of fixing a curve. He had some experimental evidence, and he needed an equation that fit the curve. So he came up with a very interesting equation that early on, he didn't know what it really meant. It took about 10 years to figure out that it was the fundamental concept in quantum mechanics. But thankfully, LEDs have come a far way from previously. They're very efficient. They're relatively inexpensive. They have a very long life for the most part. You have to kind of decide where you're going to take a gamble. There are dubious places that sell very cheap LEDs that are not very well thermally engineered, and so they have less of a shelf life than a reasonably priced LED. But I love my LEDs. I've heard from more than a few hams who have replaced their incandescents and their fluorescents with LEDs, and they love them. I tend to prefer the warm mix. The way that LEDs tend to work is the LED elements themselves do not emit white light. They emit ultraviolet light. But then you can selectively coat them with phosphors that produce other light frequencies. And if you get the mix properly made up, it gives you either a kind of a blank white, a cool white, or a warm white. I prefer warm whites myself. They're more reminiscent to me for incandescent lights, and I find that soothing. The next generation of people who aren't used to incandescent lights may decide on some other, thermal temperature for their white light. That'll be interesting to find out.
Yes, at times I have gone somewhere and have LED lights, and they just seem very harsh. I'm not sure if it's the the brightness of the light or just the color temperature?
Yeah, personally, I find that worse with early on. For some odd reason, the people designing the phosphors tended to go a little too blue for my taste. Blue light, you know, is problematic. Some people kind of love it. Some people hate it. There's been a lot of literature of dubious nature about blue light causing problems. The French have issued reports on damage that blue light can have to you. There is a eyeglass industry that probably makes hundreds of millions of dollars putting a mild blue filter, or an anti-blue filter, and calling them blue blockers. So I think it's the blue discoloration of the early, very cold LED formulations that annoyed me. They probably annoyed a lot of people.
Yeah, possibly. I don't know what it is, but it just that was annoying, and the problem that they don't burn out, so you can't replace them with another one without getting rid of a good bulb. I know I'm in the habit of taking a marker just writing down when I installed the bulb, and on incandescent, I don't know, 18 months or whatever, and on LED bulbs, I've had dates that are like 13 years I've been using the same bulb.
Yeah, it's rather amazing. I don't recall actually changing any of my LED bulbs. I swapped them for more powerful ones because I've always had a problem with the equivalency. Since they're much more efficient, most LED bulbs are something like 6 watts, or maybe you can get a real high power one for 10 watts, and then they give you the equivalency. And I don't know, for some odd reason, the early equivalencies didn't really work for me. So I've had to swap out some of my older ones in rooms that needed a little bit more illumination. But yeah, they last a long, long time. I know people who buy really cheap LEDs. Those apparently don't. So stay away from the least expensive bargain basement of LED bulbs, because they sort of defeat the purpose. So that's my little words of wisdom. As far as incandescents, yeah, those things go like anything. One of my happiest moments, I don't know if anyone out there has similar, I have a refrigerator that has a little light on it, and usually it's a night light. And even though they usually run very low current, so they run rather long, they burn out. So I bought myself an LED night light adapter. It just uses LEDs, and I think I bought that 5 years ago, and I haven't replaced it yet. I have a incandescent bulb in my oven that I tend to use just to kind of keep the oven a little bit warm and toasty, and I just keep my snacks in there to warm them up. Because an LED wouldn't kind of give you that much thermal energy heating things up. I replace those at least once every 2-3 months.
You replace the LEDs or the incandescents every 2 or 3 months?
The oven incandescent. Like I said, I leave it on all day to kind of use it as a bit of a crisper for the oven for snacks when I'm not using the oven for the regular thing. And that's just not the way those bulbs were designed to be used. They were sort of designed to be used for very short term. They don't have a good history when you keep them a little too warm, a little too long.
I never noticed that. I mean, I do recall replacing oven lamps, but I guess I don't use them that often, so they last a long time. And I do remember replacing refrigerator lamps, but I'm guessing that was may have been due to the thermal cycling going down from a, I don't know, 30-something degrees, or let's say just under 40 degrees, to whatever it takes to incandesce the bulb and then back down again.
Yeah, that might be it. I've had a lot of luck with refrigerator light bulbs themselves. I'm sure the engineers downgraded the amount of current that goes through them. That can extend their lives significantly. There are some very, very old light bulbs from 100 plus years ago that are still, they're showing them even on web pages. You can see video of the oldest light bulbs. They've been going on for a long time, but they're very low power devices, and so there's very little thermal damage apparently that they do. So I'm thinking that that's the case with the incandescent lights inside the refrigerator, at least mine. Mine's 20 years old. The little night light that's on the outside where the water dispenser is and such probably didn't benefit from that, because it used to blow out once a year, once every other year, until I swapped it out for an LED.
Okay, we've, replaced our refrigerator, and it came with LED bulbs, and I don't recall ever having to replace one on this new refrigerator, which is now, I don't know, I don't remember how old, but, I don't recall having to replace any bulbs, just water filters.
Well, yeah, that's the brave new world. You have a newer refrigerator than mine. Mine, I'm very thankful, has lasted me this long, but back in those days, probably LEDs were cost prohibitive. If really available, I guess they had figured it out, but I can't imagine how much it would have cost back then, 20 years ago. So thankfully, you know, they just lowered the voltage probably to the internal bulb. You don't need that much illumination to look at your chicken or what have you in the freezer and such. So I'm good with that. And I tend to realize that I use my oven for strange reasons. I used to have an oven that had a pilot light. So the pilot light was what I used to kind of act as a crisper for my snacks. But these modern days, I don't have a pilot light. I have a switch that, you know, sparks it when I turn it on. So I had to find some alternative way of adding a few degrees Fahrenheit to the inside of my oven when it was just sitting there. And so I've taken it to the expensive use of incandescent oven light bulbs.
Okay, that's interesting. I'm going to offer an interesting suggestion for warming your snacks. Your refrigerator, the motor is always going. I'm wondering, would that provide enough heat to warm snacks?
I guess so, if you could put some kind of a pantry. See, my I don't know about your refrigerator. Mine's thankfully an old-style one where the radiator grill is on the back up against near the wall. So there's no real room to kind of put a little pantry holder and just put the snacks is there. It probably wouldn't work well. But it's an interesting idea in general. Get some use out of that thermal dissipation.
Okay. Yeah, and I was thinking maybe even on the top, because I know, I keep stuff on the top of my refrigerator, but I have to watch what I keep there because it gets a little bit warm. Okay, I thank you for your education on bulbs and heat and turning it back to the net for, I guess, the next person.
VDH with a comment on the subject.
Yes, VDH.
Yeah, fine. This is, first of all, the heat from the refrigerator compressor in the refrigerator I have, which also has the condensing coils on the back, but that heat from the compressor is used to evaporate the water that's generated from the melting the frost off the evaporation coils. When it goes into a defrost cycle, it melts the frost off the evaporation coils, and I can hear that water drip down to a little pan that sits on top of the compressor, and that's usually warm enough to just evaporate it. So that's one thing. Other question I had related to LEDs. Do you know how short the wavelength is now from LED junctions directly? How far up into the ultraviolet have they got? I'm not talking about the phosphor LEDs. I mean direct light from the junction. How far up into the ultraviolet have they got?
Okay, that's an interesting one. I think they've gone as far up as UVC. So you could theoretically run a germicidal device using LEDs. So UVA, UVB, and UVC are able to be manifest using LED technology at this point.
Yeah, I think I have seen those germicidal LED, ultraviolet C available. I guess a related question is, how much further do they have to go beyond UVC to start hitting soft X-rays? Is that a big leap? Go ahead.
I would assume it would be more of a continuum. I mean, if you look at all those very pleasant spectrum illustrations, they'll show electromagnetic frequencies, and they'll show these little boundaries where visible light is, and below it where infrared is, and above it where ultraviolet is. And right past, probably, I would think, UVC would be the beginnings of soft X-rays. I don't know if LEDs are quite able to do the soft X-rays yet.
Yeah, I was just curious at it because it would seem at that point then we would really start to have the potential of harmful emissions or dangerous emissions from LEDs. But as you say, it is continuous. Okay, thanks, Brian.
I appreciate it.
Yes, Wesley recognized. I just want to make a comment what John said. UVC is sort of dangerous already. UVC is ionizing radiation. It can produce eye damage. Paul certainly should know from his days at work that poorly protected eyes can often be exposed to UV light during, you know, when people are welding stuff together. And basically you get an eye burn, you get a tanned eyeball, which is very uncomfortable. Much like a regular sunburn, you don't really feel it at first, and you go about your business, and a few hours later, all of a sudden, it feels itchy and painful, and you can't sleep, and it's very uncomfortable. So, even though I don't think we've gotten to soft X-rays or gamma rays, UVC is a dangerous thing and people should really respect it. You can do a lot of damage with UVC rays.
Oh, I see. Okay, thanks.
Yes, Wesley, you wanted to say something on the subject.
UVC. It's 275 millimeter wavelength, and it's 2.4 milliwatts. Now, the distance ranging is 11 to 23 millimeters from the single one. Now, there are two things, with, like everything with radiation, time of exposure and the distance. As far as distance goes, we apply inverse square law. It is not that you immediately do anything wrong to yourself. It is how far you are and how much time you spend on. And it applies to anything and everything that radiates. And to XEM.
Well, I agree with you. It's the amount of energy you absorb. UVC is highly energetic. It's ionizing radiation. It damages molecules. It rips them to shreds. It will rip up your DNA. It will rip up a lot of other organic compounds and all manner of molecules. And the amount of damage done to your molecules is based upon the amount of that radiation that gets to you, which is a function of your proximity to the source, the power rating of the source, and the amount of time you allow yourself to be exposed to the source. The problem often with ultraviolet is you can't see it, you don't really know that it's there, so you don't really know that it's a problem until later on the damage is already done, and what we tend to feel is not the initial ripping of molecules, but the secondary damage that ripping causes.
A few more things. So imagine that we have repeatable cycles, 5 minutes of irradiation followed by 1 minute of inactivity at the distance from 11 to 23 millimeters or 2.4 milliwatts at 275 nanometers, which would be UVC. But then imagine that we have the very, very resistant bacteria among the most commonly found on the skin. A rough calculation of the time sufficient for Q-log reduction of the bacterial contamination could be approximately 2 to 3 minutes. Now, how much effective UVC radiation goes to our DNA? Take the depth as the another medium. So we have a surface of the skin, we have the 11 millimeters, which would be the medium distance, or 23 millimeters, which would be the maximum distance. Now we know that starting from the source to the end of those 23 millimeters, we have inverse square law. So we don't have a 2.4 milliwatt at 23 millimeters. Now, take two millimeters thickness of the of the skin, and then ability to penetrate of the UV light through the skin. So my question to you, Dr. Roy, is what is that is the most vulnerable when we try to irradiate our finger bacteria, very resistant one, for 5 minutes? What is that can change the DNA beneath the skin, or maybe the skin by itself? Educate me.
Well, I don't exactly know what you're getting at. Again, much like I was talking to Ken about the spectrum, there's arbitrary limits of radiation exposure that people recommend for each other. The thing that we call skin is dead cells. So that's the epidermis. The very top layer is just dead cells. Pretty much, you're not going to do much to them because they don't have the DNA. They're not living. They're dead. The problem is the stuff underneath, and UV light can go through the top layer of dead cells and affect the actual living epidermis rather easily. It can disrupt cellular function. It can damage DNA. Sometimes it just damages it and kills it, which is probably preferable in a small number of cases over many, many years. UV exposure will increase the risk of malignancies, malignant melanomas being one of the real nasty ones. And again, it's a slippery slope. No one really can tell you exactly how much is going to do it. It's because it's not an all or nothing. It's not a binary situation. It's increasing the risk. So if you have 1,000 people and you keep them in the dark, chances of a malignant melanoma will be relatively very, very low. And as you let them spend more time in the sun, which has health-giving properties, it's necessary for vitamin D metabolism. The flip side is that you increase the incidence of malignancies. Also, it depends upon genetic factors. The more melanin you have, the less likely you're going to have any kind of cellular damage. So color tone is a big variation, which is probably why people who many, many, many years lived in tropical areas developed highly pigmented skin, whereas people in very Nordic areas where sun exposure was very minimal and they needed every bit of sunlight to metabolize vitamin D, they had very, very fair skin and are much more sensitive to UV exposure. So it's a multifactorial problem, and it's not a binary one.
WS2N.
Yeah, well, the thing is that we take obstacles such as partial overlapping of the bacteria on the skin, sebum, sweat, the biological fluid, etc. whatever we have there. And we have a temperature in the room, let's say with air conditioning, 23 degrees Celsius. At first, a photon can't interact with another photon, but can interact with matter, so it interacts with the skin if we are on the sun, or if it's a photon of ultraviolet, and then change to heat. My question is the heat that kills the bacteria, and then we have a thickness of the screen, skin. Is it the skin that is affected by the temperature changes, and eventually the DNA is somehow affected? I mean, here's a little gray area which I'm not necessarily goodly educated. I would appreciate if you give me some additional note on that. I, of course, it's a time, but we know that the higher frequency of the photon is, the more energetic is full period. And to exit.
AC2GS, that's an interesting question, Wesley. It is not the heat. If it was the heat, you could simply pump up more infrared and use that. It would be a lot safer. It is not infrared. It is not heat. It is the actual higher energy of the photons. When the photons are absorbed by organic molecules, there is enough energy transferred where actual bonds can be broken. In non-ionizing radiation, that's not possible. The amount of energy that a given photon has is not sufficient to break molecular bonds. They can cause molecular bonds to vibrate and increase their kinetic energy. So that's why they heat up. But when you get into the ultraviolet, you finally develop enough energy per photon to break actual chemical bonds, and that's the nature of the destruction. It destroys DNA and other molecules that require life. So you expose a virus to UVC, and if it absorbs the UVC, you have damaged RNA if it's an RNA virus, or DNA if it's a DNA virus. So it's not simply heat. It's the actual ionization potential of the photons emitted.
But is it this skin that we are afraid for that could be affected by the ultraviolet radiation, or is penetration of the screen to the soft body that we are more afraid about in within given time length?
It's primarily the skin, because the way the good and the bad of UVC light is, whatever UVC light shines on, if it's powerful enough, it can kill any living thing, within reason. So UVC light is not going to get to your lungs. You're not going to develop any kind of mutation in your lungs based on the UVC light that strikes you. It is most likely going to affect surface structures, as our skin. Someone suggested putting UVC light inside us to sterilize us. That would cause damage to the inside. But short of doing that, you're just going to damage the surface. That's a limitation also of UVC. UVC is nice, but it only affects the surface. So if you have some object that's multi-layered in some way that could have viral particles trapped within it, the UVC light exposure is not going to penetrate far enough to cause that damage. For that, that's the reason why some other technologies are used, such as ozone, which kind of permeates a lot of solids a little bit better than just UVC light.
The US to N.
Yes, Paul recognized. You want to say something, Paul?
I haven't seen up for a while, but, this repeated lags behind.
Yes, please, Paul. Well, what do you have to add?
Flash problem from welding. Can I comment on that?
Yeah, I mentioned you because I'm sure you've heard about it. I hope you haven't experienced it.
Okay, no, I heard you mention me in regard to that topic. Oh yeah, I would say about four different times in my life, and it's not fun. But anyway, you know, we call it a flash if you're welding. And somebody, usually the welder doesn't happen with them unless they accidentally, you know, put their shield down or something. But it usually happens with somebody working with the welder, or somebody that happens to be walking that looks at the light itself, or even a reflection of the light. You know, if there's a sheet metal around or something and the light is reflected, somebody looks at that for, you know, more than a couple of seconds, they could wind up with that. Let me drop it. We call it a flash. The medical name is photocratitis. And I don't know, the eye doctors, when you ask them, because I've asked them, they don't really call it a doctor medical problem. You know, it's more something else, I think, in the neurology family or something like that. But the eye doctors really don't deal with that. What happens is, you know, you could have this happen in the daytime. Well, like you said before, no problem. You know, you go home, you eat dinner, and you go off to sleep. You wake up with, it feels like somebody put, you know, sand in your eyes. Let me drop. And then, you know, you get up and look around, and it's dark, naturally. You know, you're in bed. You put the lights on, and all you see is like a little glow of the light. Meanwhile, your lights are on, and the room is lit up. But all you can see is the little light bulbs, you know, just barely glowing. And that's the, you got it then. So all you can do is, you know, put, you know, warm compresses on your eyes, and go, you know, basically go off to sleep. And usually in the morning, or anytime I got it, in the morning you wake up and you're fine. But I knew what it was because I was told what you would get if you did this. So I knew if I ever made the mistake, you know, what it was. But if you were walking by and you got a flash and you didn't know anything about welding or what this was, that could really freak somebody out in the middle of the night. Boy, back to you, WS2N.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's not a great deal that medical science can offer short of tender loving care, and when in doubt, use steroids. So they probably, if it's a mild case, they probably just prefer you to just kind of let time cure it. They might give you some artificial tears or something to kind of add a little lubrication. But the time usually hails it, you know, unless you got a real heavy-duty dose of UV light. But thanks for sharing that. And I just want to add, in case I gave the sense that only ionizing light can be dangerous, laser light can be exceedingly dangerous even though it is non-ionizing. Visible light, that's laser light, produces intense amounts of light, and with light, as we've been talking to Wesley, there's heat. And so you could damage a person's retinas permanently by just the reflection of a high enough powered LED light. So be very, very cautious, you know. Don't play games with your little pointer, although they're relatively low power. The higher power, the one can destroy cameras, destroy eyeballs, destroy all kinds of things. So. Light is our friend, but also can be our enemy. So keep that in mind, everyone. Wesley, do you still have some questions or comments?
Yes, I do. Lasers you touched operate in specific ranges of electromagnetic spectrum, but they include ultraviolet. They have also visible and infrared wavelengths. I believe that in terms of radiation, The one definitive rule is, and it's calculatable, how fast something must fly through the nuclear reactor to not get the enough of the dose that could be dangerous to the health. In other words, people who are afraid of words or anything that is nuclear or radiative. So magnetic resonance was changed to NMR just because people are afraid of word nuclear. But the only danger that comes from lasers when you compare it to the ionizing radiation is that laser has a concentrated beam of light. So in other words, I'm not sure if inverse square law directly applies to laser light. Definitely inverse square law doesn't apply to waveguides. But the laser light is a hot beam of photons that has ionized zinc air around that and is concentrated. The question that I have is, do we apply inverse square law to the light the same way that we apply to ultraviolet? Because if we have one light in the room and it's 5 watts of infrared, or not, of the blue light, and you are approximately 6 or 10 feet away from the light, then according to inverse square law, we have what, 1/1000th of the power of that light that is up there in the vicinity of, let's say, 1 millimeter or 1/8 of an inch. I don't believe that is dangerous. Enter Xia.
Well, you have to understand that the inverse square law kind of assumes a classical, perfect isotropic signal. Most antennas are not isotropic. Nothing in real life is truly isotropic. So the inverse square law is sort of a best-case scenario for a theoretical construct that doesn't exist. So I would assume as the lasers are collimated light, they're very, they do have spread. Every light will spread due to the inherent limitations of diffraction limits of any optical system. So you will have a difference of the inverse square as you increase the distances. But the initial understanding of the inverse square law was kind of based upon the principle of an isotropic signal.
Yeah, the whole gain of the antennas, so Yagi antennas, is based on one single factor. You have a 260 degrees, and you're radiating 100 watts of power. And now divide this 100 watts of power for 360 degrees. And then take any direction, this is how much power you're gonna have at this particular direction. But then we have a distance. So now we have a Yagi antenna, and Yagi antenna is giving you a directional beam, which has a certain width. Or we have a laser that gives you the light that is collimated but is dispersing through the air. So then additional 10 feet, additional 20 feet is giving a certain amount of power loss. But the question is, how do we apply the formula to, and not using inverse square law, or using inverse square law, should we say that the width of laser light is, let's say, 10 degrees, and then it's a little bit more at a certain distance, and that's how we actually calculated 100 watts divided by whatever is the width of the laser? And to actually...
I'm not quite sure exactly what you're getting at. What I'm trying to do to make a little bit clearer, I hope I'm not making it more confusing, is that although it's not isotropic, if you take an intensity from any point and then extrapolate the difference in length, you'll see the same inverse square law. The problem is that you're packing all of that power into the smaller degree of illumination that emitter emits. So, as you mentioned, the Yagi is not isotropic. It does not emit over 360 degrees. It has lobes. The same thing can be said to a degree with laser light. It has a much more narrow optical aperture. Its attenuation still works on the inverse square law, but you're packing a lot more intensity into a smaller number of degrees in its radiation pattern. But it's still the inverse square law working for us.
What is the difference between laser light, collimated laser light, and a waveguide? Inverse square law doesn't apply to a waveguide and to X-ray.
Laser light is light amplification through simulated emission of radiation. It's in phase, it's collimated, it has a very low dispersion. It does not reflect back and forth on any surface. It simply travels in a straight line except for the diffraction limits of the optical equipment. So it's not exactly a waveguide. It's just a collimated source of light in the same way that a Yagi would be, except much more sophisticated and in phase.
KD2FIU.
Go ahead, FIU.
Yes, George.
The waveguide is the formation of the facility that it's transmitting on.
Yeah, but you didn't compare it to the beam of laser. If we take the laser, we have ionized air around the laser, and at the path of the laser is plasma. So then we have a different environment, and then we actually have a structure that will construct sort of the path. Enter X-ray.
KD2FIU.
Yes, for your edification, Wesley, I think George was doubling with you while you were talking, so we'll give George a chance to expand upon his thought. I think we're talking apples and oranges, though, personally. Waveguide is a transmission device, and a laser is a form of in-phase collimated light. So they're incredibly different things, but nevertheless, George, what did you want to add?
I was trying to, thank you, Roy, thank you. I was trying to say this initially. The waveguide is the facility, the actual transmission facility in formation, whether it is physical or whether it is in a frequency control. The laser itself is the signal.
Yeah, I would agree. A waveguide is a conduit, a transmission line of sorts, and a laser light would be the signal if you were. So again, it's a kind of case of apples and oranges.
VDH would comment.
No, it's not apples and oranges. One is the facility and one is the signal.
Okay, George, I was just trying to make a point that they're two different things. You want to relate them as one causes the other thing, which is fine. But they're still two separate things, not the same, but not two aspects of the same thing. That's all that I was trying to endeavor.
Thank you, Roy, for the input.
Okay, John, WA2BDH, you had a comment?
I think the way to think about it is that the power density
integrated over the beam area, that's giving you the total amount of power. Now, depending on how that beam spreads, the power density will be reduced, but the total power is still staying the same when you integrate it over that same area. For example, if it's in free space, now you double the distances, okay, you're going to follow the inverse square. But if it's a collimated beam, the area is going to stay pretty much constant.
I have a problem with that. When you have a laser beam, that what is on the path of laser beam becomes the plasma. And density of the plasma is diminishing with the distance. But then all around that laser beam, you have a different medium, which is air. That is not ionized all the way, but it's actually giving you a differentiation between that what is on its path of the photon and what is all around. And I'm trying to find out what kind of similarity it does have to the waveguide.
I'm not talking about any plasma or any ionization. You have a laser, and let's say it starts out with a quarter inch wide, a quarter inch diameter beam, so there's a certain amount of power in that beam. If you shine it on a wall 20 feet away, and let's say it spreads out to an inch diameter beam, you integrate the power density over that inch diameter, you're still going to get pretty much the same amount of total power. So in that sense, there is no ionization or anything. We're talking about the free space collimated beam.
AC2GS here. Let me see if I have the repeater. Okay, very good. You know, these are all kind of, should be considered passive devices. They do not add, they might decrease. The efficiencies of antennas are never 100%. The total intensity remains the same no matter how the distance. It's how the radiation spreads out and the area. Now, I think that if you do measurements, there's not a great deal of dispersion with lasers because they tend to be collimated, although there are better lasers and worse lasers. They all suffer some degree of diffraction limitation, and they do diverge. If you take a powerful laser and point it at the moon, it's not going to be the same diameter when it gets to the moon. It's going to be significantly large because it does spread out. And it spreads out by a factor of 1 over c squared, the distance. So you're still going to have, I think, the inverse square law for a given area. If you integrate the entirety of the dissipated signal, it should, except for absorption of some media that it comes into contact with, like dust or something, it's always going to be the same because the total integration of all the energy is going to be conserved.
Okay. The laser beam rapidly heats and ionizes already gases to form plasma. The plasma forms an electrically conductive plasma channel. That channel is a waveguide. Oh, I'm wrong. And if we take the regular waveguide, we don't have plasma in the waveguide. The regular waveguide, we can have any frequency of our choice, and that depends only how big is the waveguide. So the point where my conclusion is kind of uncertain is that is the plasma that formed in laser beam and is electrically conductive, and in theory, even though that is not at the same diameter at the surface of the moon we target that laser beam on, can we compare it to a waveguide? Because the one common point to both is that the laser beam is actually the hotter is the plasma, the more effective is the laser beam and the target location, and to X-ray.